Good afternoon and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm Priya Menon, your host, and today we are discussing a very unique research that shows that transplanting hepatitis C infected organs and then treating the condition in the recipient is possible, thereby saving lives. And we welcome the doctors who made this possible as our featured experts today. Dr. Peter Rees, transplant nephrologist and epidemiologist at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, and Dr. David Goldberg, assistant professor of medicine and epidemiology at Penn and medical director for living donor liver transplantation at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to Cure Talk, doctors.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
The patient advocate on our panel today is Connie Welch. Connie advocates for hepatitis C and liver disease. She's a certified life coach, writer, and speaker, and founder of LifeBeyondHepatitisC.com. We also have with us Karen Shellett, who was part of the study that we'll be discussing in the hour. And Kiran will be sharing his experience with us. Welcome to Cure Talks, Connie and Kiran. We will be addressing questions from the audience towards the end of the discussion. So you can send in your questions to priya@trialix.com. Or those you're listening to us on Cure Talks pages, you can post your questions in the comment sections and we'll take them up as time permits. So over to start the discussion now, Dr. Rees and Dr. Goldberg, thank you once again for being here with us. I'm kind of very excited because we're talking about something very novel here. And we are talking about deliberately infecting people with a virus and then treating them to save their lives. So my question to both of you first is, why would anyone agree to infect themselves with the virus? Dr. Rees, we'll start with you, and then Dr. Goldberg, you can jump on with your comments.
You know, I think that The short answer is that patients who need a transplant are in a tough situation much of the time. For kidney transplant, they're often enduring chronic dialysis, which Mr. Shellett can tell us more about. Sometimes for patients who are in need of a heart or a lung or a liver transplant, they can be very sick, spending most of their time in the hospital. And so because there's such a shortage of organs, we've been thinking more and more about, you know, what are organs that we can use that weren't used in the past. So a patient might accept an organ with a viral infection, basically an imperfect organ, might not be your first choice organ, but a very good organ nonetheless, in order to get out of a tough spot that they're in. What happened with this study is that Dr. Goldberg and I took a look at new therapies for hepatitis C, and recognized that the risks of hepatitis C had become manageable and that we ought to use these organs that had hepatitis C in them.
And I think just to add on here, you know, anytime someone is accepting an organ for transplant, there's always risks of known infections, but also unknown infections. And all of the patients were presented with the data that although hepatitis C treatment in the exact setting that we were doing had not really been studied, that the new therapies had been studied for many years and, you know, with cure rates of, you know, 98% or higher, many of these patients were willing to take that risk rather than endure years and years of dialysis, which is assuming that you'll even make it to transplant, because we talk about the average waiting time being 5 to 7 years, but based on certain criteria, older age, diabetes, half of people may not even survive to get a kidney transplant. So I think faced with those odds, it was something that many people were willing to take.
And that's interesting. We can also hear from Kiran. Kiran, you're here and you've gone through this. So what were your thoughts while going forward for the study?
Sure. First of all, thank you for giving me this opportunity. I'm really glad to be here discussing this. And I completely 100% agree with both the doctors who just described, they kind of described me perfectly. So in the early 2016, around that time, I was in advanced kidney disease called stage 4 of ESRD. And I was in a pretty bad shape, just to summarize it. And I was on a 10-hour per night peritoneal dialysis. And I was already on the list for a little over a year. And the PD that I was doing nightly had caused some complication, and I was that particular week I was actually scheduling to go for a hernia surgery. So in short, I was in a pretty bad state of health, and you know, everything that the doctor described physically, as well as part of it, mental, you know, it does affect you mentally, socially as well. So yeah, I was suffering, and it looked like I was staring at a very dark, long tunnel. And that is when this opportunity came in the form of a wonderful call from Dr. Goldberg. So, yeah, I was, that 2016 was a life-changer year for me. And I was suffering from kidney disease for a long time, probably 25 years prior to receiving the kidney, although the symptoms were not present back then. They were coming back with the vengeance in 2014, 15, 16, and my GFR was getting lower by the minute. So, yeah, it was definitely a game changer when Dr. Goldberg first called me and explained me about the Thinker study.
So, of course, this was a difficult decision to make, but a game changer, of course. What was your family's response towards this? Were they very supportive for this?
Yeah, so just to start, you know, how the conversation with Dr. Goldberg started, he explained me about the Thinker study in general. The phone came when I was at work, and completely unexpectedly, and he told me about the study and how it works, and he said that, you know, when the kidney is received from a hepatitis C positive donor, you're sure to catch the infection, the virus, through the donor. And at that time, I really didn't know much about the hepatitis C at all. I mean, I knew that it was a serious disease, but those concerns were quickly faded away when doctor explained more about the new Merck medication that they will be administering as soon as the virus is detected. So, you know, as the conversation went on, I was really thrilled of getting the prospects of getting kidney within several months rather than waiting several years. And as doctor had said, you know, to be that sick and to still wait for 4 long years, you never know. Patients may not even make it to the surgery for, you know, healthy enough to receive a kidney. So, yeah, when this first came about, I shared the news with my family. My daughter, who is a nurse, she came along with us to a couple of meetings that we had with both Dr. Reese and Dr. Goldberg. And the doctors during our meetings explained very thoroughly and in a very transparent manner as to how the study would proceed. And it looks to me like, you know, they have thought of every single possibilities, and what will the patient need right after the surgery, the medication, and how they will monitor it, and the fact that they will be treating me with the hepatitis C medication called Zapatier immediately after detecting the virus was comforting to me, because it will be, they were planning on going aggressive in terms of treating the disease. So my family, when I shared the news, several of them are doctors, and some of them were concerned because of the newness of the of the procedure. But a couple of them were very excited. They say, hey, brother, you should try this. This is definitely exciting. And we have definitely thought about this thing. And when I signed my consent, I was completely relaxed in my own mind with a lot of faith that things are going to be working out just fine. I was telling, being a research engineer at one point in my career, I knew that when somebody comes up with a trial procedure, definitely a lot of planning, a lot of diligent thinking goes into coming up with a plan as large and as novel as this one. So definitely I was comforted by knowing the details of the plan. And my wife and my daughter and my extended family, as well as all the friends, co-workers, they were all very, very supportive. It was like a rock solid.
Oh, that's awesome to know, Kiran. Thank you so much for sharing that. Dr. Goldberg, so Kiran was saying that he received your call while in office. So did you and Dr. Rees actually call up every patient you enrolled for this study?
Yes. So when we initially designed the trial, we had a lot of internal discussions about how to do this to educate the patients properly. And we decided that we first would call them to give them a brief introduction, then have them come in separately for an educational session, and then if they were interested, do consent. And, after we called a couple people, Dr. Rees and I said we would call a few people, and then we would see if the research coordinator would then be able to help. And it became clear to us right away that it needed to be one of us, because patients had a lot of questions, both in terms of the study, but also their own health and how it could affect them. So we would literally just split up the list, and if it was a given day that Dr. Rees had more time, he would make the calls. If it was me, I would make the calls, and we would cold call these people. And like I say, it was probably more awkward than a blind date call, because we were calling these people saying, we're from the Penn transplant team. We want to talk to you about a study where you could get transplanted faster, but get a kidney from a donor with hepatitis C. I think over time we became more comfortable with the conversation, but it was something that took some work. And we did have an IRB approved script to ensure that we were giving all people the information in the same manner.
Yes. Dr. Goldberg, what was the criteria that was followed to make the selection of people who were approached?
So the way we thought about this, and obviously this is with a lot of input from Dr. Rees and the other nephrology colleagues, was we wanted to identify people who seemed to have the most to gain, because there were potential risks, so there had to be benefits. So we looked at people that didn't have much time on the waiting list and thus would be expected to wait the longest for a kidney transplant. We also sought out people that didn't have any underlying liver disease. And we did, beyond just the routine blood tests that were done for all people on the kidney transplant waiting list, we did extra testing and a special ultrasound to make sure that they had what we called a quote-unquote normal liver to really maximize safety for the patients. And then there were a few other exclusions. And I think the other big one is that when we spoke to people, we had to make sure that they didn't have a potential living kidney donor, because we would tell them that ultimately that would be their best option. And that those were sort of the main criteria that we looked at.
Interesting. Dr. Rees, there's one question that has come up from the audience as well, and I guess this is something that was even I was a bit curious about. In the U.S., apparently, the average waiting time for kidney transplantation is more than 5 years, especially for patients with types A, B, and O blood group. And I understand from the study protocol that was online that patients with AB blood group were excluded from the study. So does blood group or type matter for kidney transplantation in general?
Yeah, it matters a lot. And basically, I think that it becomes difficult to really give a clean answer to the question of how long will it take for you to get a kidney transplant unless you know the patient's blood type. So, you know, just to reinforce what Dr. Goldberg was saying, we really tried to choose patients who were not likely to get a transplant without hepatitis C anytime soon, patients who were in this tough spot that they had to wait a long time. And I also just wanted to say that, and of course, you know, patients, the implication here is that patients with AB blood group are a little bit more likely to get a transplant sooner because they're compatible with more donors, in particular living donors. And I just wanted to comment also that, you know, listening to Dr. Shalat or to Mr. Shalat again was, it just was great because he provided such an excellent example of, you know, he was a very educated person, understood technical information, brought family members in and thought about it a lot. And we worked very hard on the informed consent process. And I think we should all be so lucky to have, you know, well-educated patients like him. I think one other, you know, a struggle that we faced and that was important to have the IRBs input on was just to try to make the materials as straightforward as possible. And I think whenever you're dealing with some complex consent procedures like we faced here, we learned very quickly together that when people brought in their friends and family, that was a very good sign because I think when people undergo research like this with so many complexities, the more kind of support they have behind them, the better off they are, because there's just a lot of information to take in. And that was definitely true with Mr. Shalat. Having a daughter who is a nurse, for instance, made us feel, you know, much more confident that, you know, they'd really had a chance to understand what was being said and make the right decision for them.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you, Dr. Ruiz, for that input. So actually, I'm trying here to, you know, walk through this entire process of having to approach people, get them to consent for the study, you know, do the preliminary test, make sure that the recipient is ready, make sure that the kidney is available. So I know, Dr. Goldberg, you did touch a little bit about how the kidneys are, what are the exclusion criteria and what are some of the inclusion criteria that you use for selecting the patients and the organ that we're going to be transplanting. So how do you select these for transplant? Like, I know you did mention, did you any tissue mapping or any other procedures performed? And how are they just matched with the recipient? Just a quick, layman so that the person, people listen can understand how this actually happens.
Right. So, there are several things that go into compatibility of the donor and the recipient, and it's more than just the blood type, but there is tissue typing that goes along at the time any kidney is offered, and that involves both what's entered into the, you know, electronic donor matching system, but also blood samples are sent from of donor blood to the recipient hospital for matching. That is done in any kidney transplant. Now, the one unique part of our study is that the drug that we were using from Merck, that was donated from Merck, Zepatier, only works against type 1 and type 4 hepatitis C. So as a result, we had to institute, with immense help from our molecular pathology lab, a system where at the same time tests were being run to make sure the donor and the recipient were compatible, were to check the genotype or the hepatitis C subtype of the donor's blood to make sure it was a type 1 or type 4 donor, because we only use donors with those two types because Zepatier works best against them and is only FDA approved for those two groups of patients. Now, we were looking, we had fairly broad criteria for kidney donors. They had to be younger donors the kidney quality score had to be below a certain value, but there was a lot of discretion ultimately to the kidney transplant surgeon on call, because ultimately they were the ones that would be implanting the kidney and doing the procedure, and we want to make sure that they still retain their ability to make the decision about whether a kidney was usable or not.
Mm-hmm. So were there any special precautions that needed to be taken, like for transplanting an infected organ?
No, because this is, it's just, you know, we always talk about what we call universal precautions, but the same thing that would be done for, you know, a recipient with hepatitis C or one without was done here. There was obviously extra checks, you know, when the that to make sure that this was a patient that had consented for one of these kidneys, but nothing else was done special at the time of the operation.
So when were the antivirals or the Zepatide drug started after the transplant?
So we started we tested people's blood on day 3, and if it was positive, it almost always the result came back that day. We started the therapy that day. There were a couple instances just due to timing that was tested on day 2 or day 4, but we wanted to test early on and to get people started, you know, at the time or prior to discharge. But again, that was something that we sort of discussed as a group and we decided just for practical purposes to do.
Dr. Ruiz, would you like to comment on, like, what are the indications to start off this drug, and how long does the patient have to take this?
So the basically, our view was that we would treat any patient who had detectable hepatitis C in their blood. One of the things that we weren't 100% sure about was that all of the patients would become infected with hepatitis C. But we were able to detect hepatitis C in the blood of all the recipients, and as soon as we could detect it, we started to treat. What we learned from this, which really nobody knew, is that in the early days after you get infected with hepatitis C through transplantation, the viral load levels can be very diverse, some very high, some very low. But we treated right away on day 3, and then we would continue the treatment usually for 12 weeks. There were a few cases where we had to extend it to 16 weeks just to follow recommendations from the Food and Drug Administration, if there was what's called a resistance genotype. But for most patients, it's one pill a day for 12 weeks. And what we found is that by measuring the virus in the blood, you know, time after time at study visits, that the viral loads almost invariably went down very fast and were often undetectable even after a month. And I think that was great news to be able to deliver to the patients. I remember many of these phone calls, and you know, I think they would feel really good knowing that they were responding quickly to the treatment, and that after, you know, a short period, you couldn't even detect the virus in their blood. Dr. Goldberg, being the real expert in hepatology and hepatitis C, could comment on whether or not he sees the same things in patients who've had the infection longer, but I think what we learned in the transplant setting is that when you know the day of the infection and you treat right away, you know, the virus responds very quickly and becomes eradicated pretty fast.
Dr. Goldberg, would you want to comment on that further?
Yeah. No, so I think, you know, the success and the cure rates that we're seeing, you know, match that in people with chronic hepatitis C. The one thing that's different is that we noted that many of our patients, because we were testing and treating them 3 days after infection, their viral levels that they started were much lower than someone normally. So if I see someone in my clinic who's had hepatitis C for years, usually they have a viral load, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 million. But most of our people, not all of them, but most of the patients, when we started their drug, they had levels of, you know, 3,000, 10,000, so orders of magnitude lower. So they were getting to a level of zero much faster. And we still continued the treatment for the recommended duration just to make sure that we'd optimize their chances of cure. But we did note that they went to zero much faster than we normally see.
It's interesting, Dr. Goldberg. Was there anybody who did not get the infection at all in the trial?
No. So there were a couple people whose levels were zero on day three, and then when we checked it a couple of days later, they were positive. But every transplant we did, the recipient developed hepatitis C.
Can you talk a little bit of whether this new drug, that is Zepatier, has any side effects that the patient should be aware of?
No, so all of the hepatitis C medications, you know, that have come out over the last several years have really minimal to no side effects. And if you look at trials when they've compared it to a placebo, to a sugar pill, the side effects are very rare. People can have nausea, headache, fatigue. We didn't note any side effects above what we'd expect. And the medications that a patient takes after a transplant to prevent rejection were much more likely to cause any side effects than the hepatitis C medications.
Yeah, I'd like to hear from Kiran now. Kiran, can you tell me, can you talk a little bit about that treatment phase and when you started taking the new drug and if you're back to normal life now?
Sure. Yes. So just to confirm what Dr. Goldberg just mentioned about side effects, I had absolutely no side effects at all, zero. And, we were totally surprised because in the previous treatments with high doses of prednisone and some other medication, I was definitely being bombarded with lots of side effects. But during this treatment with, I was on dozens of various medications, plus Zepatier, but fortunately, there was no side effect at all. Absolutely none whatsoever, to the extent that I didn't even have any surgical pain per se. I didn't even take a over-the-counter Tylenol for any kind of pain. So I really was very lucky, and especially Zepatier did not offer any side effects. And I was feeling really well within the first just few days. Even while I was in the hospital, I started walking around and feeling better and just excited to, get out of the hospital and, return to the normal life. And I started feeling better every day after the surgery. If I have to talk about today, I'm feeling 100% back to where I was maybe 10, 15 years ago. So in terms of side effects, there were none whatsoever. And during the recovery time, there was some issue regarding blood pressure, but that was corrected after a few adjustments were made. And I had some potassium level problems, which I still do to a certain extent. So I'm not completely out of woods in terms of potassium, but that is a separate issue. But other than that, in terms of any side effects due to medications right after surgery and up until this point is basically none. I'm dealing with potassium. I'm on some medication for that. But watching the diet and exercise and the rest of the good stuff is keeping everything in a pretty good balance.
I'm so happy for you, Kiran. Yes?
So just want to bring up one point, because I know we've used the term. I mean, I've talked, and Kiran and Peter, we mentioned the drug Zepatier, sort of the trade name. And the reason why we have done that, so one of the things that was sort of important to get this study off the ground was we both ethically in our own internal safety board felt that we could only do the study if we could guarantee that we could treat the patient's hepatitis C. After transplant, and because insurance is not 100% guarantee, we had to go to pharmaceutical companies applying for grants to help cover the infrastructure costs, but also to ask for donated drug. Merck was one of the companies that we went to that had agreed to sponsor it. We, neither myself nor Dr. Reese were paid by Merck, but they were willing to help, cost to the university for infrastructure, but also to donate the drug. So it's not like this is the only drug that can be used in this setting, but that's why, for the audience, why we're using that drug's name is that that's what we use because that's who we partner with and who donated the drug for all of the patients.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Goldberg, for that information. I'm just wondering, like when I was hearing Kiran, it's so good to hear you say that you're back to normal life, and I'm so, so very happy for you. This is like a great thing. I can totally understand what you went through and how you're feeling now. So, Dr. Mm-hmm. Goldberg, how much do we know of the effect of, treating HCV post-transplantation and then on effect on graft survival? And what is the data what does the data say for now?
Right. So I think, there's a lot we know, but there's still a lot we don't know. Before this study, we knew that hepatitis C could be treated before transplant or after transplant with the same cure rates. And that's, though, in the setting of people having chronic hepatitis C. Based on what we've seen so far and other published studies or things that have been presented in meetings, it seems that even in the setting of acute hepatitis C, when you're acutely infecting people, the cure rates are no different. I think the jury is still out on how does this affect graft function. Historical data, and Dr. Reese can speak better to this, has suggested that kidneys from donors with hepatitis C weren't quote unquote as good as from those for people without hepatitis C. However, those organs were largely used in people who already had hepatitis C and liver disease, so it was very difficult to parse out, did the organs not do as well because there was something with the organs, or did the organs not do as well in terms of who they were used in? The data that we published, I think it came out officially in September in the Annals of Internal Medicine, though, showed that at least at a year in the subset of our patients who had reached a year, their graft function, sort of how well their kidneys were functioning, was better than we would have expected based on their kidney quality score. But I think, though, that's only a year, and I do think this is why this is still an evolving field and one that is still, I would argue, still sort of has a lot of unanswered questions and is still in the realm of experimental because we can't tell patients at this point, 5 years down the road, we think your kidney is going to work just as well as if the donor was hepatitis C negative. We're very hopeful, and the early signal is that that will be the case, but it's far too early to be able to conclusively say that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So I have just one more question before I bring Connie on. I know she has quite a few questions for both of you. I believe that this treatment is being tried out for other organs as well, and there's a heart there's a trial on heart transplants going on as well. Can you talk a little bit on that?
Dr. Reese, why don't you?
Sure. The question is, what's our experience been with heart transplantation?
Yes, right.
Okay. Well, I think the results of the THINKER trial and the experiences of the patients encouraged us to try out a similar model in heart transplantation. So far, the results were pretty gratifying. So we have conducted and continue to conduct a trial in heart transplant where we take hepatitis C-infected hearts and put them into uninfected recipients. I can say qualitatively our experiences in talking to patients have been really different because many of the heart transplant patients are just, even across the room, much sicker than the kidney transplant candidates were. Many times they're continuously receiving drips of fluids to try to give their hearts a little bit of an extra push. They're often, very fatigued and short of breath walking across the room. Some of them we've talked to while they were in the hospital because that's where they were spending most of their time. So I feel the informed consent process was sometimes, even more intense. but I think the need is every bit as great. And so we partnered with some great people in the Division of Cardiovascular Surgery and Cardiac Medicine, including Rondell and McLean and Mike Acker, among others. And, you know, they were great partners, and all the patients who've been in that trial who were able to, you know, finish the treatment have also been cured. The other thing that's been, you know, very gratifying for us at Penn is that, you know, many other centers have kind of asked us for our materials and, you know, asked how they could develop similar programs. And so we now are aware, you know, every week of programs elsewhere who've taken up similar programs. For instance, at Vanderbilt, they've also done a trial where they transplanted 9 patients where the donors also had hepatitis C and the recipients didn't. So I think slowly the story is starting to grow, and it's happening at other places in heart transplants besides Penn.
Well, that's great to know. Thank you, Dr. Reeves. So with that, I'll now hand over to Connie Welch. So Connie, please go ahead with your questions for the doctors.
Okay. Well, first, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today. I appreciate that. My first question really is for Dr. Goldberg. In regards to liver transplant, has this study ever been done transplanting a hepatitis C infected liver to a patient who perhaps had cirrhosis and was in the later stages, but that the transplanted liver was not as damaged? So there was a greater, you know, outcome as far as when the patient could go ahead and start on the antiviral drugs.
Yeah, so this, you know, in transplantation, we, you know, routinely have used livers from donors infected with hepatitis C, especially obviously those that are younger with less time with the infection whose livers were normal. Historically, these were, though, used in people with hepatitis C. There was a recent study that was just published online from Stanford where they performed 10 liver transplants from donors with hepatitis C into recipients without hepatitis C. The thing that's different in livers as opposed to other organs is because there's still many, many people on the waiting list who are infected with hepatitis C, we, as a transplant community, use livers from donors with hepatitis C as much as we do livers from donors without hepatitis C, meaning that we're just as likely to transplant one of those because there's so many recipients. So using, at least now, livers from donors with hepatitis C into people without hepatitis C allows us to transplant someone who's maybe a little more sick than the patient with hepatitis C, but won't necessarily lead to a marked increase in the number of transplants because these organs are used with such frequency.
Mm-hmm. That's good to know. That opens up definitely a lot more organs, which is wonderful. My next question would be, is there any information that would, or any evidence showing that there is any problems with anti-rejection drugs along with taking the hepatitis C antivirals?
Short answer is yes. So it depends, though. So the main immunosuppression drug that we use in all transplant recipients is something called tacrolimus or Prograf.
Mm-hmm.
It varies by drug, but the interactions between the hepatitis C drug and tacrolimus is fairly minimal and very clinically manageable. For people who might be intolerant or have an allergy or something to that, they sometimes then will require a medication called cyclosporin. That is different, and there are very important interactions between cyclosporin and the hepatitis C medications that really affect the dosing. Now, almost always you don't know if someone is going to be intolerant to tacrolimus prior to transplant and require cyclosporin, but on the off chance that you have a patient who does that, you know, in our study, we would not have enrolled someone who we knew ahead of time couldn't take tacrolimus and would require cyclosporin because that interaction is so profound.
Okay. That's good information. I appreciate you sharing that. Now, one thing I'd like to recap a bit. You had mentioned earlier that you do not wait necessarily for the patient to get a significant viral load before you start treatment. Do you see this standard protocol to be used in the future?
So I think that is something that's been discussed a lot in the community. You know, for us, it was partially, and I had asked Mr. Shalat this when we had all spoken at a meeting, what he would have said if I told him we have the medication, but we're making you wait 6 weeks. And he told me he wouldn't have been as enthusiastic. So we had the medication, so we felt that it was important to start it early. Now, in the real world outside of a trial, I don't foresee a way that you would be able to start treatment that early, because unless the hospital were to purchase the medication up front, you'd require, in clinical practice, to have the patient get a viral level, apply to the insurance company, get approval, and get the medication, which would take several weeks. So what we do in our study may not be what would happen were this to become standard of care.
Right, I understand that. And I appreciate that information, because there is a lot of, patients, who have maybe, have to apply for their insurance company and maybe have to work through some paperwork and everything. So it's just good information. My next question would be, from my understanding, the United Network for Organ Sharing, based here in the U.S., has had a policy guidelines that throughout the country, anywhere in the U.S., it's divided into 11 regions, which include 58 territories known as the donation service areas. But up to this year, a general transplant policy states that each area has first right at organs collected from their area, in which the sickest patients from that area are first in line. Only when an organ is deemed unsuitable for all patients in that area is it made available to patients within the region or then nationwide. Do you see this policy changing in any way with hepatitis C infected organs becoming more widely available?
This is Peter. I think I'll take this one. So, I guess what I would say is that organ allocation is really changing quickly, and it's changing a lot for different organs. Sometimes because there have been lawsuits demanding changes in allocation, and sometimes because the community has recognized that it could be done better. I think Dr. Goldberg and my general view is that hepatitis C-infected organs really should follow the same allocation process that other organs do, with the sole exception that I think it's fine that people have to opt in to get these offers. But, in general, when we allocate, organs, the allocation system should balance what's fair with what's going to, get the most benefit for the patient population. And so, in general, there's always going to be trade-offs here. On the one hand, you want people who live in different geographic areas of the United States to have the same access to organs, but it's a lot easier said than done to make that happen, just because, as an example, if a heart becomes available in Seattle, the neediest person, the person who, might have a really strong claim to it, might live in Philadelphia, but if you fly that heart all the way here, it might get damaged on the way. So I think there are some tough compromises being made, but I think the simple statement that I try to sort of push towards people about hepatitis C-infected organs is that in the past they were treated as sort of, higher risk and maybe just to be reserved for people who already had hepatitis C. And now I think what we're starting to show is that these are high-quality organs. Hepatitis C can be cured. There's no real reason to sort of only give these to patients already with hepatitis C. And so I think in general, the allocation of these organs in the future, I hope, will just follow in general the same process that all other organs do, whether or not they have this infection.
Okay. Well, that's very good. Thank you for that information. So Dr. Goldberg,
thanks for asking.
In the case of for Dr. Goldberg, in the case of liver transplant, is there any liver damage acceptable to be transplanted, like in the case of fibrosis? Is there any liver damage that's excluded to be transplant eligible?
So from you're saying from the donor's perspective?
Yes.
Yeah, so I think there's some variability among centers. Now, some places will always biopsy the liver of a deceased donor with hepatitis C before using it to make sure that there's not significant scar tissue. The challenge, though, mm-hmm. becomes is how accurate is that read going to be, especially if it's in the middle of the night in a remote hospital where there may not be a pathologist familiar with liver tissue to say how much scar tissue there is in the liver. So there are some places where they will only, well, they will biopsy and they require minimal to no fibrosis. Some will say only stage zero, some stage one, and some will go up to stage two. Anecdotally, you know, some surgeons I've spoken to at our center and others really go by feel and appearance. And if it doesn't appear, you know, abnormal or fibrotic or stiff in any way, they'll accept it. But it usually has to have, you know, minimal scar tissue. They wouldn't take a liver with cirrhosis, but if there's a little bit of scar tissue, especially all of the things, if it's a younger donor or things like that, they will use it. It does not have to be completely devoid of any scar tissue.
Okay. Well, that's very good information as well. Thank you. My next question would be, what is the recovery time period that y'all saw in this study for these patients?
You know, for kidney transplant patients, the time course, I think, for the THINKER trial really looked a lot like it did for patients without hepatitis C. The way I kind of look at it is that, you know, there was kind of like a storm around transplantation. The patient is emotionally keyed up. They go through a surgery. They get a lot of fluids. You know, afterwards, they're, you know, briefly in the kind of ICU setting. They transition to the floor. They started, you know, they came to the hospital on 10 medications. Suddenly, we're giving them IVs, and then they leave the hospital on 10 medications, most of which are different. And all these people are talking to them about, you know, all the education and what life means now that you have a transplant inside you. And in many ways, I think the fact of getting hepatitis C was an important but sort of medium-sized part of a big event. And I think Mr. Shalhoub mm-hmm. could probably say a lot more about that. But usually these patients were in the hospital, you know, maybe 3 or 4 days. And then for a period, and even on the first day, you know, out of bed, walking, you know, maybe by the second day, starting to eat fluids and starting to have some of the tubes removed and the dressings changed. And then, you know, they would usually be discharged to home or to a local thing that we have called the transplant house. And then it's sort of a period of 2 weeks of getting back into a daily routine. You know, we encourage them to walk. We encourage them to really spend a lot of time studying their medications. But often they mm-hmm. can't drive for several weeks. And while I think they could usually do self-care at home for that, you know, first 2 to 3 weeks, we really encourage them to have someone there just so that, you know, if you have to take a nap or you have to be driven to the pharmacy to pick up some medicines or, you know, you just need a little time, you know, need a little help with dressing changes, there's someone kind of there for you. So anyway, I think it's usually around when patients are about, you know, 3 to 4 weeks out that they start saying, wow, I'm really kind of getting my energy back and starting to feel like myself and feeling like I've kind of mastered this new set of things that are demanded from me in terms of, you know, keeping track of my medicines and everything else. I hope
that's
very, what...
Go ahead.
Oh, no.
That is.
Go
it's
ahead.
Very good information because, you know, so that is something I think patients have to consider, especially after being discharged from the hospital and kind of in terms of what they can expect for recovery as well. My next question would be, does this study include working with living donors who have hepatitis C?
So it does not. You know, I think in theory, you would with a living donor, just, you know, ultimately from a, you know, societal perspective, from a cost perspective, you would want to treat the donor first, and then if mm-hmm. everything's okay, then do the transplant, just because mm-hmm. treating, doing the transplant and, you know, then infecting someone, which does pose a risk, to me, I think ethically wouldn't make sense when you could treat the donor and just delay the transplant by a few months and not put the recipient mm-hmm. at risk.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that as well. I didn't know, like, it's a requirement for a match for a kidney patient. And if they're only, relative that had a match for a kidney happened to have hepatitis C, I didn't know if they would be considered, even though they had not been treated yet with antiviral drugs. So, but I would think that would be something they would have to take up with the doctors and insurance company and see what they could right. do to help resolve that.
Right. Okay, anecdotally, I do know of a few colleagues that told me that they had a similar situation, but they opted to treat the donor first and then do the transplant mm-hmm. so they didn't increase any risk to the recipient.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very good because that very likely could come up and have a plan in place. Well, my last question would be, from my information, this was a pilot study, and if that's correct, could you explain what the difference is between a pilot study and a clinical study?
Well,
this is
you're saying
the doctor.
What's the difference between a pilot study and a clinical study?
Yes.
Well, you know, I think what's going on now, just sort of a debate in the transplant community, is whether or not, you know, these organs should really be transplanted under research protocols, or whether or not centers mm-hmm. should kind of have the latitude to just accept the organs and do the transplants, and then maybe, report their outcomes later. Mm-hmm. But, you know, our view is that it's still a pretty early days using these organs, and that everyone from the patients to the transplant community at large will benefit more if, first of all, if there's research oversight and, there's an institutional review board from the institution saying, you know, we've approved your protocol, we're making sure that you follow your protocol, your informed consent is safe and thorough. Because, you know, if someone does have a side effect or a bad outcome, I think it's important that everyone felt confident that the way the study was conducted was, you know, the best. And also that, you know, if the studies didn't go well, that people could step in and say, I'm sorry, you have to stop it. So we consider this a pilot research study, with oversight. There are other centers that are doing this just as part of routine clinical care with less oversight. We're not exactly sure what kind of consent processes they're putting in place, and then publishing the results. So, you know, we think that we know the right way to do it, or the safest way to do it. But there's definitely some debate, and also some debate about, you know, when it would be okay for this to transition to standard of care. We don't think we're quite there yet, but we think we'll get there soon.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. Well, thank you both to Dr. Reese and Dr. Goldberg for your work in pioneering this new frontier and making more life-saving organs available to patients. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Connie. Those are wonderful questions. What we have is we have some questions from the audience, doctors. So I see that we have kind of covered quite a few of what has been asked. We just quickly summarize it again for the people who asked the questions. So the question which has come both to my email as well as there on the website is that whether this transplant treatment is being done on other organs, and I believe we talked about heart transplant. Maybe one of you doctors, but Dr. Reese, Dr. Goldberg can just reinstate that.
So this is being done in liver, lung, and heart transplants. We at Penn have our ongoing kidney transplant trial, a ongoing heart transplant trial, and are now launching our lung transplant trial. Other centers are doing this, some as formal trials, some as just single center sort of protocols or experiences. So it's variable how it's being done, but those all four of the major organs are being used in some fashion.
Thank you, Dr. Goldberg. The next question is, again, something that we have answered, but let's revisit it. It says, how long does a patient have to be on the Hep C meds after the transplant?
So for our study, we are following the FDA package label. So for, you know, 95% of the patients, they get the 12 weeks of Zepatier, a small subset who have a specific variant of one of the types of hepatitis C have required 16 weeks. We felt like, you know, because the medication was being donated by the company, you know, cost was not an issue. And sort of other than side effects, the main reason to give someone a shorter course of therapy was cost. But we felt like it was safest and sort of most ethical if we were going to be doing this to give patients the full course of therapy.
Thank you, doctor. So I'm just going to wrap up with that now. So of the nearly 100,000 people waiting for a kidney transplant in the U.S., many will never get one. Meanwhile, hundreds of hepatitis C-infected organs are discarded because of the infection. We've just heard Dr. Rees and Dr. Goldberg talk about how it is possible to transplant hepatitis C-infected kidneys into a patient and treat the disease in the recipient, thereby saving his life. This revolutionary treatment is certainly good news. And we look forward to more data from trials on this treatment, as well as those using this to transplant other organs as well. So Dr. Rees and Dr. Goldberg, thank you for your time and for sharing all this information with us. Kiran,
thank you so much
for participating. Kiran
Sheller,
thank you so much for participating and sharing your story.
Thank you very much.
Great
thank
to
you
hear
so
you.
Much.
And
thank you.
Connie, thanks a lot for bringing in the patient perspective to this discussion. And we also thank University of Pennsylvania and the audience. The talk will be available on curetalks.com and curetalks at Penn Pages. Please visit our website for details on upcoming talks. Thank you, everyone, and have a great evening.
Thanks, you too. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.